Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Kristen Largen, and I'm here with the Seminary Explores podcast. And I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Dr. Craig Foltz. Dr. Foltz is an adjunct lab instructor in the physics department, having joined the staff in 2015 following a retirement from a four-decade-long career in research astrophysics. And also, he served as program manager at several university and research centers. And we've been having some conversation before we went live, and he's had really quite a fascinating career. So, Craig, it's really great to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Kristen. Thank you very much.
So we're continuing. I had said that we have been interviewing some scientists from the college. You all have been great down there to come up and share your time and expertise with us. In light of the fact that we did receive an AAAS grant to talk about science in the seminaries and why science might matter to people of faith, and so it's great to have you. And I thought we'd start by just having you say a little bit about how you got into physics.
Sure.
And a little bit what you do. And
sure, I grew up in the 60s, went to college in the 70s, and I don't know why I studied physics. I know why I studied astrophysics.
Okay.
And that was, I was at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and this was an era when we were first starting to talk about black holes.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, none had been discovered. They were theoretical arguments that they should exist and so on. And if they did exist, what could they do? And so there was lots of discussion about that. And also, there was a lot of curiosity about very, very luminous objects in the universe called quasars, or quasi-stellar objects, which are still the most luminous. They put out the most energy of anything in the universe, and actually it turns out they're very large black holes.
And I'm going to just have you stop and say, just to remind all of us, what a black hole is.
Okay.
And what a quasar is.
Okay, a black hole is a collapsed object. We all know about gravity. Gravity mm-hmm. means that all matter attracts all other matter, for the most part, as long as it's not charged or anything. And so if you take an object like the sun, the mutual gravity of all the material in the sun tries to make it collapse. And that is offset in the sun by the fact that there are nuclear reactions going on at its center, which increase the temperature and the pressure. And that supports the sun against collapse.
Okay.
So it's in what's called equilibrium.
Is that what's going on for the Earth also?
The Earth has structural strength.
Okay.
I'm talking about something gaseous.
Oh, got it. Okay, yep.
Like a star.
Okay.
If those nuclear processes at the core of the sun stopped, the sun would collapse, and it would continue to collapse until there was something that would stop its collapse.
Does that happen quickly or over?
No, it's over some period of tens of millions of years.
Okay.
You got no problem.
Okay. I'm good.
We got 4.5 billion years.
Okay.
And the sun will, actually, what will happen is the sun will get very, very large. It encompasses the Earth will burn up, and then eventually the sun will collapse into this thing called a white dwarf, which is an object about the size of the Earth with the mass of the sun.
Wow.
Extremely dense material.
Okay.
And basically, it's supported because you can't push electrons too close together.
Okay.
It's called electron degenerate matter.
Okay.
And so that stops it. It will not collapse any further. If you took a star that was several times bigger, and there's another alternative sort of in-between state called a neutron star, but if you take a star that's, say, 2.5-3 solar masses to collapse, nothing can stop the collapse.
What force overcomes the repelling of the electrons? And just the gravity
just
is so strong.
The gravity is trying to support, trying to make it collapse. The fact that you can't push the electrons any closer together is opposing that collapse.
Okay.
So it'll have a spherical structure.
Okay.
And it'll just sit there and cool off and turn into a...
But in these really big stars, the gravity is strong enough
that it's strong enough that it actually forces the electrons into the nuclei.
It does.
In the end, it produces something that is so small and has such overwhelming gravity that no light can escape from it. Okay, so and light is affected by gravity.
Okay.
It's weak. Gravity is the weakest of the fundamental forces. So in a situation like that, if light can't get out, the escape velocity is faster than the speed of light. You can't go faster than the speed of light. And with I'm not going to talk about quantum mechanics, but essentially that material that has collapsed has sort of pinched itself out of the universe, and all that's left is this, there's the, is this mass.
Okay.
There's no light escaping from it.
Okay.
Things can fall into it. It can accrete matter. You know, matter can, gas can flow into it.
Okay.
Okay, but now we know these things exist. We know there's one at the center of our galaxy. We really do know this, although, I mean, we have very exquisite data that show that there is a very large collapsed object at the center of our galaxy. It's about 3 million solar masses.
Wow.
And it has stars that orbit around it, and we watch these stars orbit around this thing that is producing no light.
Okay.
So
we know it's something that's got a gravitational force.
It has that kind of mass.
Okay.
Okay. And in, and we believe that in there's probably such a creature, creature's not a good word, such a structure, a black hole, a large black hole, at the center of every large galaxy.
Wow.
And in many cases, for very large black holes that are accreting matter, as the matter falls into the black hole, it heats up dramatically. It emits a lot of light. It's very luminous.
Okay.
Now, the light is not coming from inside the black hole. It's coming from material that's falling onto it.
Wow.
And these are, these were first sort of seen in, first understood in the 1960s. I remember this. I mean, I remember Time magazine had the picture of Martin Schmidt, who was an astronomer who's only recently died. Recently, in sort of my terms, 15 years ago.
Just a moment ago. Yes, fair enough.
But he was their cover picture because he understood that these things that looked like stars, they were a little fuzzy, so they were called quasi-stellar.
Oh, okay.
Were actually objects at extraordinarily large distances, further away than anybody had ever seen anything before. Now, by what we know now, it was a pittance. It was, it was next door.
Yeah.
But because we could see them, and because they were so far away, they had to be producing enormous amounts
of
energy.
Okay.
And so that's what I studied in my research career, which is, I'll say, is we put it into sort of temporary suspension for a while. I don't.
What does that mean?
I don't do much research anymore.
Okay, okay.
In fact, for the last 12 years or so, I worked in support.
Okay.
I worked for the National Science Foundation, which is an independent agency of the federal government.
Okay.
An independent agency means we did not work under a cabinet member. So NASA isn't, that's a federal term.
Okay, well, yeah.
Yeah, it's, there are independent agencies and then they're not. NSF has about a 7.2, I may be living in the past here, $1 billion a year budget.
Man.
And it's charged with supporting science, technology, education.
Wow. But all branches of science,
Not except for health sciences.
Oh, okay.
NIH does.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay.
So I worked in the Directorate of Math and Physical Sciences, which was physics, astronomy, chemistry, math, material science.
Okay.
And then there was a director for biology and so on.
Okay.
I worked in a division of astronomical sciences, and we supported small awards to individuals, small teams. These might be awards of a few $100,000, maybe up to $500,000 or so for a 3 or 4 year award, and small groups. And we also supported very large multi-user observatories that were available to anybody who wanted to use them as long as their proposal withstood merit review.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I worked in support of that, mostly overseeing very large telescope projects.
Okay.
Including a brand new solar telescope that's being built on Maui on top of Haleakala.
Right.
And a very large cosmic camera called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which in 10 years we'll all know about because it'll be really, it's the coolest project that I've ever been involved with, which is being built in Chile.
Wow. Are all of these projects international kinds of projects? I mean, do you all play well with others across national?
We try.
Okay.
We try. And, and we've always been, I think I can stand a very, I puff up my chest and say, we have always accepted proposals independent of from country of origin.
Oh, that's great.
Independent of citizenship.
That's
and
great.
So on.
That's great.
And that came at some expense. There are other national facilities built by other nations where U.S. Astronomers are not welcome.
Okay.
This is changing.
Okay. Who turns out great astrophysicists?
We still do the best.
Do we?
We do. Okay. We do. We know how to train researchers.
Okay.
We know how to build collaborations.
Okay.
And we know how to build wonderful, wonderful facilities that can be run, well, you know, I'm going to say for reasonable costs.
Okay.
But those reasonable costs are tens of millions
of dollars. Well, yeah, of course.
So, you know, astronomy is expensive. It's not expensive like very high energy physics,
okay.
For example.
Okay.
You know, our facilities don't touch things like the Large
Hadron Collider. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, we are now entering an era where the new generation of telescopes are approaching, let's say, you know, 300 million to a billion.
Oh, man.
That's a lot of money. And at that level, even from the feds, it's very difficult to raise that kind of money
inside.
And you are encouraged, it's a little schizophrenic, where you're encouraged to find international collaboration.
Okay.
But then the complexity of the management
becomes
extremely expensive.
Yeah.
And so one has to sort of defend and understand. And, you know, somebody put it once, we recently completed a large radio telescope array called ALMA, and it's at 16,000 feet in the Atacama Desert in Chile.
Okay.
It's an array of radio telescopes. It's fabulous. It's the kind of thing you say, this gives me faith in our species. That we would do this.
That we could do something
that
we
would even think to do this. Right?
Okay.
I mean, it really gives me chills. But, you know, it was a joint project.
Okay.
It's about, let me think, it's about 40% U.S. money, an awful lot of U.S. expertise, 40% European Southern Observatory, and then various, the Japanese are in, the Canadians are in, Taiwan is in.
Okay.
And as the project manager once said, talking about the interaction between the countries, said, even if you're a minor player, if you're contributing $250 million, you cannot afford to lose any arguments.
Huh.
So
Okay, yeah. Management
got very complex.
Yeah,
oversight gets very complex.
Sure.
And there are cultural differences.
Yeah, oh, I bet.
And so you know, that's always a challenge, and it's not necessarily a challenge that scientists are trained to deal with.
Well, I want to come back to the telescopes, but first I want to ask you what the difference is between an astrophysicist and an astronomer.
There's no difference.
Oh, okay.
There's really no difference. There was, you know, there was a time when everybody was called an astronomer.
Okay.
And there were astronomers who did things that were very sort of foundational, looking at the motions of stars in the sky.
Yeah.
That's very important. It turns out our understanding of the universe depends on our understanding of how the galaxy works and how stars pulsate and so on and what their masses are. And these were very sort of standard observations. There wasn't a lot of physics involved.
Yeah,
You wrote them up.
Right.
And then starting with in the 40s or so, when we started to understand what makes stars work, which we didn't, I mean, remember, this is all new.
Yeah,
you know, we didn't know about fusion.
Yeah, sure.
Relativity, early 20th century.
Yeah.
But it wasn't 100 years ago that we didn't know what these fuzzy patches of the sky were that were outside of the Milky Way. I mean, away from the sky.
Yeah.
Extra galactic, out of the Milky Way. Now we interpret that as way out, but this was just in the sky. So, and, you know, it was Hubble and others who said, oh, these are other systems like the Milky Way. That was less than 100 years ago, right? So now
amazing.
We know there's hundreds of billions of other galaxies.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see them way back in time, and we're trying to see them be created, which we should be able to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, and I'm still going to get back to the telescopes. I'm reminding myself that's a verbal note. But when you're talking about kind of the early, the early astronomers, I mean, they're for many societies, and this is not my area of expertise, but they were religious concerns as well. And you read that like way before they would have been able to see anything, right? There was a sense in which, or before they would have been able to explain it with the math, they had a sense of what some of these things were and how they, and I always find that amazing.
Yeah, also, I mean, you think about Galileo, right?
Yeah, sure.
He got in big trouble.
Yeah.
but he was, the standard model at the time.
Oh, right, yeah.
Was not a Christian model,
yeah,
right?
No.
You know,
right,
the whole
right,
Ptolemaic
right.
system, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway.
There's a lot of, I mean, I guess what I'm thinking about is there was always, and I'm thinking about even, you know, pre-Christian
sure.
societies, I think there was always a lot at stake.
Yes.
Right? I mean, in terms of...
The Chaldeans and the Babylonians.
Yeah.
I mean, astrology, right?
Right. So it's, yeah.
We won't talk about it.
No, we won't. We could, but we won't.
But it was very important. But think about that. You know, Kepler was an astrologer.
Yeah.
You know, Kepler took these marvelous observations that Tycho made, and he figured out how the solar system worked.
Yeah.
Newton then explained that with gravity.
Yeah.
Einstein then said that's not all there is to gravity, and he did general relativity.
Yeah.
And general relativity begets black holes. You know, so it is a continuum that starts somewhere a long time ago.
And it's funny. I think you can either take it two ways in some sense, again, speaking as a person of faith. Like, on the one hand, you could say, you know, how majestic, O Lord, is your creation in all the world. I mean, this idea of the amazingness of it, and the more you learn, and that there are galaxies upon galaxies, and the time and the space involved. I mean, it's miraculous. But the other thing that does is so relativize human existence, right?
Sure.
And I think for many people that doesn't feel very good, because I think here you are, this teeny little speck on a speck in a speck of the... Wait a minute, right? We're supposed to be more important than that. So I think there are for people still a lot of ramifications about them. What does it mean to be human? But I mean, your point about what an amazing thing that humans are able to do,
right,
to be able to build and to study,
right,
you know, that's lovely.
Well, thank you. You know, people ask me, what good is it?
Yeah.
And, you know, when congressional staffers ask you, what good is it?
Oh, because, of course, they're giving you some money after all.
And you say, well, you know, it's a gateway science. It brings people into science. You know, we have all this sort of standard verbiage about how many things we get over the fold in the New York Times or the Washington Post.
Oh, over the fold.
That's
important.
Sort of things.
Yeah.
But in the end, you know, personally, it's like art.
Yeah.
It's good for your soul.
Yeah.
It's good for my soul.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We've always wanted to understand.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's necessary. I'm not a person of strong faith.
Yeah.
I have had many discussions. I have a very good friend who was the former director of the Vatican Observatory.
Oh, wow.
Who's a Jesuit and writes.
Love those Jesuits.
I love the Jesuits. I love them.
And even, I mean, we could stop for a minute. The Vatican has an observatory, right? I mean, that's sort of a fascinating thing. What's that like? Have you been there?
Absolutely. It's in the Pope's Summer Palace in Castel Gandolfo.
Come on!
I spent like 3 weeks there. It was fabulous. You walked out and you walked into the castle. It was the old Gandolfi family. It's incredible. There are the three volcanic lakes. Nemi, which is where, what's his name, Caligula had the big barges built, right?
Okay.
That were sunk and restored, and they were destroyed by airstrikes during World War II. But there are these three volcanic lakes, and Castel Gandolfo is on the rim of one of these lakes.
Okay.
And it's where Domitian had his villa.
Okay.
Who was a great persecutor.
Oh, of course.
And it's where the Vatican gardens are, and the Vatican dairy, and the Vatican chicken coop. I mean, you can go see the Holy Cow. So we drank milk from
Holy milk, really? Why not?
But in right off the main, in fact, the Pope's summer residence is there. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's not there all summer.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the Vatican Observatory sits on top, and there are actually some telescopes there, and there are some little telescopes out in the Pope's summer gardens, and they're staffed by Jesuit astronomers, all of whom are Jesuits and have PhDs.
Of course,
they have research careers.
Wow. Did the church build it? Did the church pay to build it?
Yeah, the church was interested in timekeeping.
Yeah.
Church was interested in the glories of God.
Yeah, right.
And actually, the Vatican has the observatory has a collaboration with the University of Arizona in Tucson.
Oh.
So they will have the Jesuit astronomers in residence in Tucson.
Okay.
And they actually share a little telescope, actually a decent-sized telescope, a 72-inch telescope, on one of the 10,000 feet on one of the mountains outside of Tucson. Wow. So, you know, this trying to understand this.
Yeah.
I must admit, I do not spend much of my time thinking about it.
Okay. You've got enough things to think about.
Well, you know, I was talking. I drove up to your parking lot today, and I looked at this absolutely smashing setting. It's beautiful up here. And I looked at, you know, the wonderful clouds and the spire of your chapel, and I thought, how complicated things are.
Yeah.
That we would have a universe that would make such a place with and creatures who can do such things. You know, you can wax that way.
Yes.
You know, when it comes down to it, I'm more interested in, you know, what's going on? Where's all the matter in the universe? You know, what are the outstanding questions?
And are you interested in those questions just for the questions themselves, or they do have larger ramifications for you? Is it part of a larger picture?
For me, I think it's still curiosity.
Okay.
It's, you know, there's been such growth in my time as a, I think I, in thinking about this before I came over here.
Yeah.
The changes that I've seen in only 40 years.
Is that been because of the what technology in terms of telescope?
In large measure, yes.
Okay, has been made possible.
It's been made possible by that. It's been made possible by adequate, if not abundant, research funding.
Okay.
Which is not just federal, state, private. Astronomy has always benefited much more than physics. We have two things. We have much better pictures.
That is true.
We win.
Yeah.
You know, you can scout. We win the picture competition, right?
Yes, you do.
Because not only do we have pictures of the heavens, we have pictures of these marvelous structures, these telescopes, right?
Yeah.
And so we have always benefited from private funding.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is a new telescope. I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it while we were recording. It's being built in Chile. It's a giant camera, and all it will do is take photographs of the sky, one after the other, after every 15 seconds.
Wow. Okay.
Each one of these, each individual image will allow you to see things a million times fainter than you can see with your eye. And it will produce many, many terabytes of data a night. It will look for transient things, you know, things that explode, things that move. It will... Eventually, all these data will be overlaid to produce the deepest, widest... All the accessible sky will be revisited every few weeks. It's basically being built to try to understand what the dark energy is, which we could talk about if you wanted to. It's really one of the most outstanding questions right now. But it is...
And you keep saying there's nobody manning or womaning that telescope?
There'll be a staff there.
Okay.
Absolutely. But it's...
The program gets programmed. Okay.
But what I wanted to point out was it was funded, the design and development, which NSF supported.
Okay.
They enjoyed $20 million of Bill Gates' private money. Not his foundational money.
Okay.
But
his own.
And Charles Simonier, who was another Microsoft, wrote $10 or $20 million dollar check.
Why wouldn't you want to be involved in something
so
like that?
So we've always had that. The LHC doesn't get private funding.
So. I want to ask you about how telescopes work for a minute, and then we'll come back to dark matter. And I just want to say again that if you're just tuning in with us, this is Kristen Largen here with the Seminary Explorers podcast, and I'm so pleased to be having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Craig Foltz, who is in the physics department down at Gettysburg College and an astrophysicist. And we were just starting to talk about telescopes I know so little, I'm not even sure I can formulate my question. Like, so when I think about, you're talking about taking a picture. So I think about holding up my iPhone and taking a picture. But I'm thinking about the distances that are involved here. And so how does a telescope, and even the telescope itself, at the magnitudes that you're talking about, how do they work?
Well, first of all, I'm a bit of an optical chauvinist. I tend to think about telescopes as things that live in domes on top of mountains and work it.
Yes.
In colors of light that you can see with your eye, right?
All right.
Or nearly.
Okay.
And really, that's not the whole story.
Okay. Is it bad that you're an optical chauvinist? I don't even know what that means, but if you're
frankly,
one, I think I like them.
Frankly, I don't care.
Okay.
I've used radio telescopes. I've used X-ray telescopes.
Radio telescopes.
Okay.
Oh, I was, of course, just thinking about optical.
Optical telescopes.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the fundamental, so many fundamental changes have happened. We have radio telescopes on the ground. We don't tend to have them in space yet. But these are spectacular arrays of giant dishes, right?
Okay.
Hundreds of dishes.
In
this plateau in Chile, right?
Okay.
At 16,000 feet.
Okay.
Looking at, trying to bore through molecular clouds to see star formation in the Milky Way, or see protoplanetary systems forming, see disks of gas and dust forming planets around other stars. I mean, this is spectacular stuff. And it does that by observing light at wavelengths that we can't see. Right?
Okay.
So in the case of the last telescope I described, it's more like microwaves.
Okay.
If you think about light going from radio waves, it's all the same phenomenon. Radio waves, microwaves, infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. They're all the same thing.
Okay.
It's just the same. It's just they have different energies.
Okay. Okay.
And when they have an energy in the range that you can detect with your eye, that energy is interpreted by our eye as color.
Okay.
So red photons, red bundles of light, have less energy than blue bundles of light.
Okay.
Okay.
So amazing. Okay.
So the idea of a telescope is collect a whole heck of a lot of that light.
Okay.
As much as you can grab.
Okay.
And figure out some way that you can measure its characteristics.
Okay.
And maybe that's just making an image.
Okay.
In fact, an enormous amount of modern astronomy is done with image. And it could be an image taken in X-rays.
Okay.
So you could look at the Crab Nebula, a supernova remnant, and you could take a picture of it with an X-ray telescope called Chandra that's up in space.
Okay.
X-rays don't make it to the ground. That's a good thing.
Oh,
that's
all right.
That's a really good thing.
Okay. What would happen if they did?
Well, they're mutagenic.
Okay.
I mean, they're carcinogenic.
Okay.
I mean, that's why they put the
lead. We all look really different.
You know, you go to the dentist to put that lead thing on you.
Okay. Alrighty. So they, how come they don't make it?
They ionize.
Okay.
Air.
Okay.
I won't say
okay.
exactly which.
Okay. Good.
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, a lot doesn't make it through. A lot of infrared gets absorbed by water.
Okay.
In the atmosphere. Gamma rays don't make it either, and that's probably a good thing.
So that's why we need telescopes in space.
That's why we go to space.
Okay.
And it's very expensive to go to space.
Okay.
It's titanically expensive.
I can't even imagine. What kind of telescope is the Hubble telescope?
It's an optical infrared telescope.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a 100-inch telescope.
Okay.
That means it has a mirror in it that's 100 inches in diameter.
That's
chump change. That's an itty bitty telescope. You can put that mirror. I mean, you have a lovely office.
Yes.
You could fit the mirror in
here. I could fit the mirror in here.
The mirrors that we're talking about for modern telescopes are 30 meters, 42 meters.
Wow.
For the ones that are really, really going after the faintest light, objects.
Okay.
That's not necessarily all you want to do.
Okay.
I mean, there are,
right.
The newest solar telescope, which will be the biggest one in the world that is currently in construction on Haleakala, is a 4-meter telescope.
Okay. And what's a solar telescope?
Just looks at the sun.
Just looks at the sun.
Yeah, it's special.
The sun is special.
Well, it's very special. And this telescope is unbelievable. This telescope is so special. It's made to have unbelievable detail, image quality.
Wow.
That if you took a quarter, I'm trying to work this out, and move to a distance of 100 kilometers, and you pointed this telescope at somebody 100 kilometers away holding
a quarter,
it could read the date.
Okay.
You don't do that for
$29.95. No. No, you're not going to get a special on that.
So anyway, you build your telescope. You build it to function. You build it to a specific kind of job. And this is different than it used to be.
Okay.
It used to be we would build these spectacular, wonderful, beautiful machines. Perfect. You know, there's this great book about the Palomar 200-inch, which when I was growing up was like,
the
temple.
Yes.
It was called the Perfect Machine.
Wow.
But they were built to do many, many things. And we're still doing that to some extent. But we're also doing sort of purpose-built. You know, we're building the LSST to attack a certain kind of problem. We're building the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope to attack problems of the sun.
Okay.
And, you know, we build ALMA, this large array in Chile, to look at problems of star formation and galaxy formation. So, you know, it's gotten to that point that the field has grown so wide and so rich that you need different tools.
Yeah.
And the tools are expensive.
Tell me about how you know. I mean, one of the things, again, in my, you know, things that came to me in the course of my learning and study, I don't even know how they came to me, but the amazement of being able to see things so far
so
away. And so I think about, but it takes time for all of that light to tell me about that. How do we know how far away that is? How does that light? So when you say this telescope is taking a picture every 15 seconds, it's not only, it's taking a picture of
everything,
things that are close, things that are far.
Everything in that direction.
And how do you get the depth on that? How do you
figure that out?
Okay. Tell me how to figure it out.
Well, maybe you look at the colors. Maybe
okay.
You say that has the typical color of a galaxy at a distance of 5 billion light years.
But how would you even develop a standard for that? How does any
generation upon generation?
Okay, of calculations
of observations, you have building foundation of looking at what nearby galaxies look like and what happened. You know, the universe is expanding.
Okay,
I mean, you know, back to the Big Bang.
Okay. We're still in the bang part.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
We're accelerating, which is the hardest thing to figure out. The bang is not slowing down.
Okay.
And that was it's amazing now. It's almost 20 years, not quite. 18 years or so. The understanding that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. It should not accelerate. It should slow down.
But maybe we're just not to the slowdown point, right? We don't know.
Gravity should slow it down.
Okay.
Because gravity never stops. You know, it drops off as 1/distance squared, but that never goes to zero. And so all the matter in the universe attracting all the other matter should slow down this expansion of the universe.
Okay.
And it's not.
It's
speeding up. And that's where the dark energy comes from. But anyway, we have many lines of evidence. I would say we are sure, but I'm not going to say that.
I don't care.
The Big Bang, as a thing, the Big Bang has no viable competitors.
Okay.
That was not true when I got into the business.
Yeah.
And we know that the universe is evolving. We know that it's changing.
Yeah.
We can look back. I mean, think about this. This is pretty straightforward, right? What Edwin Hubble did was he looked out at these extragalactic nebulae, which he understood to be other galaxies like the Milky Way, collections of stars.
He was the first one that realized that?
He and others about that time.
Okay.
In the first quarter of the 20th century.
Okay.
Actually, Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, called them ion universes.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did. He did. Now, he had no reason. I mean,
right.
You know.
That's
but anyway.
Interesting, yeah, okay.
What Hubble found out is that they were all moving away from us. And, you know, at one point you say, hey, we're special.
Yeah, right.
We're really special. And what he found was that the speed with which things were moving away was directly proportional to the distance.
Okay.
So if you had something that was, 3.26 million light years away. And I actually chose that very carefully.
Okay.
Nowadays, if we look on average, something at that distance is moving away from us at 70 kilometers a second.
Wow.
Okay?
Okay.
If you go twice that distance, it's moving at 140 kilometers
per
second.
Wow. Okay.
So that's so that number, 70 kilometers per second per 3.26 million light years is actually what's called a megaparsec. So the number 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec is Hubble's constant.
Huh.
It's our understanding of Hubble's constant.
Okay.
Now think about this. If you go twice as far away.
Okay. And Hubble's constant is what demonstrates this rapid expansion continuing.
Well, it is a characterization.
A characterization of it. Okay.
It tells you about how the expansion is going.
Okay.
At least locally.
Okay.
So it's like this: you're standing on the side of a highway, and you look a half mile away, and there's a car moving 30 miles an hour, which you can measure.
Okay. Sure.
You look a mile away, there's a car that's moving 60
Okay.
Miles per hour. A mile and a half, 90. Okay, that's analogous in many ways. It says that those cars are moving at rates of 60 miles per hour per mile.
Okay.
And if you think about that, you say, how long ago was the car that's moving 60 miles an hour here?
Oh,
it was here a minute ago.
Yeah, you could, okay.
How long ago was the one that it was here a minute ago? They were all here a minute ago.
Okay.
So a linear expansion like that says everything was here once.
Oh, how interesting. Sure.
Now, that puts you in a really special place, naively. That says we are at some center, but that's not the way it works. Okay? It's not things moving out into pre-existing space. It's an expansion of space.
Okay.
So in the Big Bang, if I take those cars back to when
yeah.
they were here,
okay.
that's like taking all those galaxies and saying, when was a galaxy a megaparsec away? If it moves at 300, or it moves at 70 kilometers per second, how many seconds does it take to move a megaparsec? And you do that calculation.
Okay.
It's actually just
you could do that calculation.
It's easy. It's the reciprocal of the Hubble.
Honestly.
It's all just units.
Okay.
And you find out that it was here 13.7 billion years ago. So all the matter in the universe was here. And all the places in the universe.
But you don't mean here. Literally, we're moving too.
Nah, we're all. It's space is expanding.
There is no here.
All right. The standard way to. Yeah, there's no here. Think about it like rising dough.
Okay.
With raisins in it.
Okay.
That's a lovely analogy, except that.
That's fabulous.
That's a finite universe.
All right.
All right. Now, we're not quite there, but if you buy that.
Okay.
That space is expanding. So, you know, you take two points out in space, and you come back later, they'll be further apart.
Mm-hmm.
Just because
the
space is expanding. So, that leads you to, you know, you run it back, and it leads you to a time when, you know, space was collapsed or
mm-hmm.
small,
mm-hmm.
and the matter was all here,
mm-hmm.
and it was darn hot.
It was hot.
Darn hot.
It was really hot.
Really, really hot. It was so hot that you really couldn't really even distinguish between matter and light.
Okay.
Everything was fully relativistic.
Okay.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so, you know, and I don't think that's why one said, let there be light. But it was all,
right.
all acted like light. Now, you say, okay, prove this to me. Well, what are the ramifications? Well, the ramifications are, the universe was not always the way it is now.
Okay.
I should be able to see that.
All right.
If I look 5 billion light years away, I'm looking back in time 5 billion years.
Okay. Oh, right, because you're right.
It took that
yes,
time
for the light to get there. Right. Okay.
And you say, okay, well, you tell me that 13 and a half billion years ago, there was a Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go and look 13 and a half billion years, light years away, I should see the Big Bang. And you do.
You do.
You do. You see. It doesn't matter.
Can we see that far?
Yeah.
We can.
But it's not. Here's the rub. Okay. First of all, it doesn't matter which direction you look.
Okay.
Because you're just looking back in time.
You're just looking back in. Oh my gosh! My mind is just almost dripping out of my ears. But I'm still with you. It's just amazing.
So here's we're almost there, right? So what when things move away from you? Their light gets shifted to red longer wavelengths.
Okay.
The energy of the photons decreases.
Okay.
So it's called a red shift.
Okay.
All right. And remember, the further you go away, the faster things seem to be moving.
Okay. Right.
So if you look all the way back to sometime about 100,000 years after the Big Bang, it's moving really fast. It seems to be moving really fast away from us. So those photons, which were emitted at a time when the universe had a temperature of about 3,000 degrees. It had cooled off a lot because
okay.
it was really, really hot.
All right,
it's 100,000 years. It cooled,
okay,
quite
cooled
a,
off quite a bit.
About 3,000 degrees
okay.
are now characteristic of a gas at 3 degrees above absolute zero. Very cold. It looks very cold. And so where it emits is in microwaves.
Oh, okay.
And so this is called the cosmic microwave background.
Oh, my gosh.
It was discovered in Holmdel, New Jersey, using a dish that was meant to communicate with the Telstar satellite. And they had this extra noise in their signal. And they couldn't figure out where this came from. And it didn't matter where they pointed it.
They always
saw this noise. And they went out and they found out that pigeons had taken residence in this horn. And, of course, pigeon poop has temperature. So, you know, it would have been a source of them. Yeah. So they shoveled it out, and they still had the noise. And what they finally realized with the help of another astronomer just down the road in Princeton.
My gosh.
I think that's right. I may be wrong there. But was that, no, they were seeing the remnant of the Big Bang. Now, we can study this remnant. We study this now, and we study it from space with these unbelievably sensitive observatories in space. Mm. One's called WMAP.
Okay.
And we look for little structure because it's the universe was, it started out smooth. How did it go from being smooth, just smooth uniform distribution of gas, to being lumpy? The universe now is lumpy.
The universe is lumpy.
It's lumpy.
It's like people.
Yeah. We're
lumpy.
We get older. Kind of settle.
The lumpiness sort of thing.
I can deal with it.
It's all right.
So anyway, that's the stuff. You know, we look out and we see the Big Bang. And you can ask, well, what else? Well, you should see changes. You should see mm-hmm. the universe should be different. And it is different.
And it is different.
You know, if I look at the number of quasars that are around now, there aren't any big ones.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
existed back in time.
Yeah. When I was talking with Dr. Stevenson, your colleague, she had said that's the, you know, to talk about a theory, it needs to predictive, or I mean, it needs to be able to say, okay, if this is true, you should be able to see these things,
and it does, like,
yeah, and
it needs to be testable.
Yeah.
It needs
yeah,
to be
right.
You need to be able to rule it out.
Yeah,
and you can't rule it out.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Now there are issues. There are serious
sure.
issues. We don't know how. We don't know how the galaxies formed so fast.
Okay.
We don't know how black holes formed in the early universe. We don't see the first generation of stars. We should be able to soon.
Okay.
You know, we'd like to see, you know, making stars. Look, the universe started out as hydrogen and helium. That was all.
Yeah.
And now we got gold and platinum and stuff. And, you know, so that's wonderful. That all happened in stars.
Okay.
Stars do that.
Okay.
But to make a star out of just hydrogen and helium is very hard. Because the gas that was it tries to collapse can't cool.
Okay.
So these are still issues. It's not the structure of the universe, but it's the evolution of the stuff in the universe.
Okay.
There's still a lot
that's
of
interesting.
And there's still a lot of work to be done. Enormous amount of work to be done.
Yeah.
So
that's exciting. Well, we are at time, and I have a million other questions for you. I'm going to hold myself back from asking them, but thank you so much for spending time with us.
It was a pleasure.
You're a delightful teacher, and I just think I can imagine how it would be really important in your field to be engaging and clear, and how easily when you talk about science the way you do, that you could get people excited about
it. Oh, thank
you. It's just fabulous.
That's very nice to hear.
Yeah. All righty. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.